session number 16251, reel 3.
Where'd you enter reel 3?
We did have our alarms, of course, particularly when you heard the wire rattling with the tin cans that we put on. But we were under strict instructions that unless the Japanese burst through the wire, we were not to use weapons like Sten guns and machine guns, anything like that, because it would give away the position of the troops defending the perimeter. Instead, we had to use grenades, which we used to lob over the wire and hope that that would deter the Japanese from trying to get through. I don't ever remember any part of my perimeter killing a Japanese, but we did manage to kill the buffalo that wandered too near the wire and rattled the cans. We fed quite well for a few days after that. It was a pretty terrifying experience in Ray at Kohima, because the Japanese were so dedicated to their emperor that they would die, in fact, rather than give themselves up for capture. And I only remember one occasion when, after we had cleared Kohima and had broken out on the road to Imphal. Well, when we were on the way to Imphal, I was driving an ambulance vehicle for some reason or I can't remember why, when I got a roadside thumbs up from somebody waiting there, and he nipped aboard, and it was a Japanese who decided he wasn't going to have any more. And he had no weapons, no nothing, so I took him back to the battalion headquarters and they passed him on to brigade. And because it wasn't often that a Japanese gave themselves up.
What condition was he in?
He was pretty debilitated. I think he was suffering from beriberi. He certainly wasn't very sprightly. But I don't know the outcome of their questioning of him. But it's quite interesting that I should be one of those who took a prisoner back.
Did he attempt to communicate with you in any way?
He couldn't. We didn't speak the same language. He just indicated by signs to go ahead, you know.
So he just thumbed a lift?
Yes, he thumbed a lift, really, yes. The breakout was accomplished as a result, of course, of the battle of the DC's bungalow and tennis court. And that was something that was virtually like a theatre show in many ways, because so many of the trees and branches and so forth had been blasted because of the shell fire, our own as well as the Japanese, and the mortaring, that we at battalion headquarters had a very good view of what was going on down in the tennis court, because we knew that this attack was going in, and we knew it was going to be the attack that would, in fact, clear the Japanese eventually, because they had succeeded in getting a tank up the hill by winching it up and then letting it roll down onto the actual tennis court itself. And this tank was a Honey, if I remember, a Honey tank. It's the name we knew it by anyhow. It might have been a Grant or something. And it sat there in the middle of the tennis court once it had got down there. And it was the driver was a chap called Waterhouse. And the attack was assisted by A Company of the 2nd Battalion of the Dorsets. They were thrown into it there. And they went around rather like Guy Fawkes Day in many ways. The tank sat there pumping shells into the holes, and the foxholes and the bunkers around the tennis court. And the Japanese were spilling out of the rear end. And as soon as they started to run down the slopes, the rest of the battalion, machine guns, mortars, caught them in crossfire there. And where there did meet resistance on one or two of the bunkers, the battalion, or at least a company in this case, they had explosive devices on the end of what they called a long bamboo pole. And they poked these in the hole, and they were timed to go off within 4 seconds. And this, of course, was the thing that eventually cleared them. And it was, I walked around the battle, you know, it was something that was exciting in its way, that last we got them out of it. I walked around the battlefield afterwards, and the thing that struck me most of all was the number of bodies that were lying around. So many of them in a state of putrefaction, where they've been lying out in the open for so long. After all, it only took 2 or 3 days for the flies and maggots to start coming. And what struck me as much as anything was to see a soldier who'd gone shorn and 17 days later, long hair. You know, these are things that the hair had continued to grow even though he was dead. These are the things that struck me most. But the party was kept busy burying Gus Claxton, it was, and Gus is still alive. I heard of him only yesterday, actually, because there was a padre. Where was I yesterday now? There was a padre, anyhow, that I met, who was from the Padre's Staff College at Camberley, and I asked him particularly if he knew of Gus Claxton. He said yes. Said, as far as he's aware, he's still alive and is carrying on, but he's getting a bit decrepit now. Well, I'm not surprised. After all, he was a little older than me. The fact was that he was, in fact, a very good padre, and he looked after all religions because the Catholics had lost their Father Callahan had died as a result of being blown up by a mortar bomb. So he took everybody under his wing. And he used to look after us very well. In fact, we put him in charge of the rum ration, which was not always the most successful thing to do with the padre, I must say. But he... we haven't put our... Sorry a minute. Anyhow... And Gus was a great chap, and we very much appreciated his services. He had a hard time, had so many people to bury and that sort of thing. The 2nd Division, of course, once we'd pulled out, went back later after they were pulling out and erected a memorial at Kohima itself. The Naga hillmen brought a huge piece of granite down and gave it to the divisional commander. And this was put down on a site near the DC's bungalow. And they got somebody to come along and put the inscription on it of what is now known as the Kohima Epitaph, which is the one that when you go home, tell the most and say, "For your tomorrow, we gave our today." And this was, in fact, on the 2nd Division War Memorial. But now, of course, it is used in all of the occasions when the epitaph is required to be said by not only the 2nd Division, but other divisions using it too, who were in Burma, as something that is most appropriate to the occasion, I think. When we broke out, we bypassed, went down the road, and we were relieved by the East African Division, and we were pulled out of the line for a few weeks, and went on leave, some of us, to Calcutta. And after we got back, and it was quite a long while, we had 7 days in Calcutta. It was nearly 2 weeks before we could get back, because the transportation problem was still very acute. We also got reinforcements, but a lot of the reinforcements came locally from Royal Artillery regiments, like anti-aircraft regiments, sort of thing, which were disbanded to provide recruits for the battalions, because there just weren't any troops coming from overseas, from the UK. They were all being taken up in the D-Day landings, I suppose, at that time, or in Germany, France and Germany. And it was a hard time because we didn't get very much of good equipment, and the engineers and the signalers, all these people had to improvise an awful lot, and we ourselves had to improvise to make the best of what was available to us, because so much of it was diverted to the Western Front in Germany, France and Germany. But the point is that this didn't do us any harm, really, because when eventually we came back of our leave in Calcutta, funny enough, I must digress on this, while we were in Calcutta, they showed a film called Burma Victory. And, you know, Clark Gable, I think, was a chap.
Errol Flynn.
Or Errol Flynn, one of them. Yeah. Errol Flynn, yes. Was a chap who won it single-handed. So the cinema didn't last very long with the British Second Division being there.
Did they smash it up?
Yeah, they smashed the place up, absolutely.
Because of Errol Flynn?
Errol Flynn winning this on his own, virtually. I know that, Matt. Sorry about that. Anyhow, we passed through down through the Kabul Valley after the East Africans had pulled out, and they went ahead of us, and they erected this Bailey Bridge over the Chinmen River in conjunction with the some engineers. And it was, at that time, I don't know whether it still is, reputed to be the longest Bailey Bridge that had ever been built in wartime. And it was huge, there's no doubt about that. And it did span the Chinmen River. We got across there, all right, and broke out into the Mandalay Plain afterwards, through places like Shwebo and all that sort of thing. And we pushed ahead at a massive rate, sometimes 20, 30 miles in a day. And we always took with us our patients. And the only way we could do this was to borrow transport from our fellow field ambulance, like either 4 or 6, because we weren't able to evacuate malaria cases because the ADMS had ruled that all malaria cases were to be treated locally so that they could be returned to the battalions without any loss of time. Previously, they had gone out by air evacuation, and by the time they were treated in hospital in Calcutta or any other place that they went to, and then came back, a period of 3 weeks, sometimes a month, would elapse before they were able to rejoin their battalions. So it was ruled that malaria cases were to be treated by the field ambulances right forward. And that's why we had to form, more or less, a casualty clearing station from the personnel of the field ambulance. They did produce a casualty clearing station a little later, where we were able to evacuate backwards to them from the L5 pilots, the Quakers, who used to come in, and we used to have prepare airstrips for them, and in other words, breaking down the paddy fields and this sort of thing. And I'm full of admiration for these L5 pilots, because the way they were able to land those planes on these ad hoc aerodromes was fantastic. They could only take one patient at a time, and as a lying patient, or two sitting. But they were volunteers, they were Quakers, and they would never take up arms. But they did their bit in helping us out. They were Americans mostly, and they provided, the Quaker organization provided quite a lot of the planes. It was quite fantastic to see them come in, I must admit. And here we broke out, and we got down eventually to the Mandalay Plain, where it was hot and dusty and sticky. We'd got through, we'd fought previously through the monsoon, which was something that General Slim had said we would do, and it was a most horrifying time, trying to fight in a monsoon rains. You talk about raining heavily when we get sort of 40 to 50 inches a year over here. Over there, you get up to 600 and 700 inches of rain a year. And you can imagine all that coming down over a period of the monsoon of, what is it, 5, 6 months? 5 months, probably. All that rain coming down all at once over a five-month period. Anyhow, once we got to the Mandalay Plain, it was quite good going, and the Japanese, strangely enough, didn't stop to fight on this side of the Irrawaddy River. They decided that they would go the other side, obviously, to defend we arrived at the riverbank, and this is where we found the big problem regarding equipment, because there was no way we could get across that river without boats. And I remember the engineers working day and night, sawing trees down and cutting them into planks, putting these planks together and making sort of barges of them. And we had a few ducks, but not very many. And all the divisions were more or less placed the same way. They all had to improvise and build their own method of getting across the river. We'd been taught how to make a river out of stretchers and all that sort of thing, you know. Didn't really work, though. One or two tried it, and their little stretcher boats went down without doing anything at all, so decided not to try it that way. Eventually, the attack came in to cross over. My division were to attack, and I was given the charge. I was the RSM of the unit by now, because the previous RSM had got fever, tick fever, in our previous location, and he went down and had to be evacuated. And I don't know whether he died, a chap called Ravenhilton, whether he died or not. Anyhow, I took over as RSM, and I was given the job of coordinating all the evacuation procedures right along the whole of the brigade front. And I was based virtually with the Camerons at that time. And the Camerons effectively made a bridgehead across the river, which was at that time probably 3/4 mile wide, I suppose. And they made a 300-yard bridgehead. And the other battalions formed up afterwards and gradually extended the bridgehead right through. So the CO, Colonel Baker, who was eventually awarded the DSO himself, and I, because I was, it was here that I was awarded the DCM, because of the fact that I was going across the river back and front under fire all the time, evacuating casualties from the forward medical posts to the medical post to be established this side of the river in the river bank. And we evacuated quite a lot of casualties back, and it was quite a hairy time. In the meanwhile, 19th Division had crossed the river north of Mandalay, and they swept down from the north to Mandalay, and the battalion of the Dorsets moved in from the south, and they were very hurt to find that 19 Div had beaten them to Mandalay. You know, it was a sort of a... I would think they probably had a bet on it, I imagine. Anyhow, the COs of the battalions that relieved Mandalay and took it met at Mandalay, and we were very pleased that it was all over from that point of view. And shortly after that, I was due to come home anyhow on Python, because I'd gone out there in 41, and it was now late on in 45. So they decided that I should go home on Python. So I just got back to Calcutta, and then across by train to Bombay, and a ship back to England. And of course, the war in Europe was over, so there was no problem regarding being having a submarine sink us or anything like that. There was no problem there. It. I got back sometime in August, I think. The Dorsets went to the Dorsets went on because they had got a lot of reinforcements to actually go to Japan itself. But I left my field ambulance because I was due home, as I said. The homecoming itself was quite a hairy one for Betty because I'd managed to get a cable off from Southampton to her to say that I was arriving at Waterloo roughly such and such a time. And she was there at the time that I would arrange to be in. We didn't know whether the trains were going to arrive on time or anything like that. But she was suddenly faced with about 500 fellas in bush hats, all yellow, all looking the same. And she didn't know which one to look for.
Yellow from quinine?
Yellow from mepocrine, actually. And I didn't suffer from malaria then, you know. It was a very, very good suppressor, was mepocrine. So I never had a dose, any dose of malaria while I was there. But eventually I spotted her in a leaning against a pillar in a red dress. So we got...
A red coat,
I should say, yes. We got together and hired a taxi to take us across to St. Pancras, which was the nearest station, to get to St. Albans. And when the taxi driver saw that I was wearing the old Bermuda hat on there, he refused to accept any payment, just took me over. And I was very pleased about that. As you can imagine, at least it something that he recognized. And this is what struck me about the parade, in fact, you know, in London, that the people there, for once in their lives, realized that besides the European theatre war, there had been another theatre war, where the so-called Forgotten Army were suddenly recognized. And I've never seen such massive crowds in all my life. And this gave me that choky feeling another one gets on occasions like that. It was very impressive. Anyhow, I digress with that, I'm afraid. Once I got back to England, I went straight to my depot after I had met Betty, and I reported there, and they sent me off on 2 weeks' leave. And I went back to St. Albans, and strange enough, I went to the King William IV pub, which had been my regular haunt before going out there to Burma. A new proprietor. And I was in there with a bush hat on, and VJ Day came along, and I was there, and I wanted a drink. The fellow had already put the towels over the pumps, indicating there's no further drink available. I didn't create about it at all. Do you remember, Matt? And suddenly the door opened, and this was only 8:30 at night, opened, and two fellows walked in. 2 pints, please. And he took the towels off the pumps, pulled them a pint each, and then put the towels back on again. So I was a bit irate, as you can imagine, not having been served myself. And I went up to him and said, "Hey, what's the idea of giving these two fellas drinks and you refuse me?" He said, "Those are my regulars," he said. "Don't you know there's been a war on?" At which I blew my top, I really did.
First time I've ever seen you do it.
I'm normally a very level-headed chap, but this was... I could have willingly throttled him. Fortunately, I kept my temper and I just walked out. But I felt very bad about that, to be honest. It's somebody couldn't recognise that there's no way I could have been a regular at his pub. When I got back to my depot, I was posted to A company. Memory's a little indistinct on which company. I served in about 4 different companies while I was there, finishing up with headquarters. Yeah, but that there, you see, I went back there again after I went out to Palestine, wasn't it, in 1948. And I went back there again. That's when I went to holding and drafting afterwards. And I served there with the recruits, training recruits. Didn't like it very much. Too much bull about it then. I'd got used to a more relaxed attitude towards soldier training. And eventually when I went to headquarters, I was much happier because I was at least doing administration there rather than recruit training and all the bull that goes with it. Then I was posted to Korea. And I blew my top.
To Korea or Palestine?
No, to Korea, first of all. And I blew my top and asked for an interview with the Director General. I haven't put this in. I told him that I wasn't very pleased that I'd had a hard war, been abroad 3.5 years, don't have seen my wife just for a couple of few weeks. And the point was that there were people in the depot who had been there when I went abroad, and they were still there when I got back. And they were fit people. And I told him, and I could have been court-martialed for